So I want to welcome you to the Second Court of Appeals for our second oral argument of the day. For those of you who might have been watching the first oral argument, you'll have noticed that there's a panel change. So I will introduce myself and reintroduce the other justices on this case. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. And I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the parties have all checked in. And so without any further ado, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call number 02-25-497-CB, Rainrock Capital Partners versus Tews. May it please the court, Mr. Thomas J. Williams will argue for appellants, and Ms. Caitlin Hubbard will argue for appellees.
Thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. To defeat the TCPA motion at issue here, Mr. Tews was required to establish by clear and specific evidence a prima facie case for each essential element of his malicious prosecution claim. And of course, the standard is well settled. Clear evidence is that which is unambiguous, sure, and free from doubt. And a prima facie case is the minimum amount of evidence necessary to establish a rational inference that the allegation is true. Then, of course, the court reviews the matter de novo, considering all of the evidence and doing so in the light most favorable to the non-movement. Of the essential elements of a malicious prosecution claim, there are two I'm going to focus on this afternoon in our discussion, and those are the elements of absence of probable cause and causation. And I'll take them in that sequence. The absence of probable cause element requires Mr. Tews in a TCPA procedural context to establish by clear and specific evidence that when Mr. Richardson went to the police in March of 2021, his belief that a crime had occurred was not objectively reasonable given all of the facts and circumstances as he knew them at the time and believed them to be. And of course, as this court said in Vu versus Tran and has in other cases, in analyzing this element of the claim, the plaintiff carries the burden of disproving probable cause, and the reasonableness of Mr. Richardson's belief is in no way to be negated by the failure to disclose other information if he did so. So because we're analyzing Mr. Richardson's state of mind and universe of knowledge at a fixed point in time in March of 2021 when he goes to the police, I think it requires us to look at least some of the evidence of the specific events that occurred, and importantly in this case, events that did not occur in the relevant time frame in 2019. And we do so, it seems to me, not because we are engaging in a battle of the evidence, not because we're trying to be the fact finder, because that's not appropriate at the TCPA stage, but because we have to analyze whether Mr. Tews carried his burden to establish that Richardson's belief that a crime had occurred was not reasonable based on everything that was known to him. And so
what are we supposed to do with the 2019 W-2 form in terms of determining that mindset?
Your Honor, a couple of things on the W-2 form. First of all, it is not an admission that money was properly earned and the employee is entitled to it. The only thing the form says is wages, tips, and other compensation. So it's a report to the IRS that a particular employee received money and that it was booked as taxable income. And that's all it is. Now, in their briefing and in their pleadings in the trial court, Mr. Tews suggested that they should have amended something to report it as theft. But that is simply their opinion. It's the kind of unsupported opinion that Darrigan versus American Prospect and quite a few other cases from this court have said is insufficient. There's no cite to the Internal Revenue Code. There's no cite to an IRS reg. There's no affidavit from a tax expert. So I don't know that could have been.
So we don't know what possible benefit could have inured to the company if they had amended to report it as a theft, based on this record?
Correct. We don't know. And more importantly, we don't know what the consequences to Mr. Tews would have been. Does that make it not taxable income to him, and he just gets it tax-free? We don't know that based on this record.
Well, but the company had an obligation to the federal government to accurately indicate what wages had been, in fact, paid, okay? And had an ongoing obligation to make sure that was corrected if, in fact, that was not a correct statement of what was going on. And so it's 2 years later when we get this complaint to the Haltom City Police Department, and there's no evidence in the record whatsoever that any interchange between the federal government and the company with regard to that W-2. So do we not have equal inferences here?
No, Your Honor, and for this reason, because the W-2 accurately reported to the federal government that Mr. Tews got the money, and he did. Now, perhaps there would be an obligation to amend one of the returns if he gave the money back later, or if there was some recovery of it. But this is reporting to the government that an employee has received money. It's been booked as wages, tips, or other compensation. That's all it says. And of course, the withholding and FICA is reported. But nothing on the form, or from what we know from the record, it gives rise to any presumption that the employee actually was entitled to it. I'd suggest to Your Honor, the case when there's a mistake.
And I don't know the answer to this, okay? But on the W-2, it would indicate if there were any taxes withdrawn and paid to the federal government as FICA.
Yes.
Or anything of that nature. Does the form indicate that there was any tax paid to the federal government on any of that amount that's represented on the W-2 form?
Well, Your Honor, you can't tell. The form certainly reflects that withholding was taken out and FICA was paid. Now, his total compensation was $781,762. So that includes both the money that is at issue here, to which he was not entitled, and another sum of money to which he was entitled and did earn. So from the form, you cannot distinguish between the two. There's no doubt withholding.
We can't tell whether the company paid taxes on the amount that the company was disputing in terms of whether or not it was appropriately paid or not.
Well, the company wouldn't be paying taxes except for the company's share of the FICA.
But they're obligated to do that.
Right.
Okay. So one would think that if they don't think that this amount was properly paid, that they would dispute having to withhold money as tax for the amount that they're in dispute, and that they would do something to dispute it immediately as opposed to 2 years later file a criminal complaint about it.
Well, the withholding obligation is there. Now, perhaps down the road, if the money were repaid by the employee, there might need to be an adjustment. But that's what we don't know from the record. We have no authority from the Internal Revenue Code given to us in the briefing, and no affidavit from a tax expert, which there could have been.
Okay.
So, Your Honor, with respect to the sequence of events, I want to just touch on a couple of items, because I think what is important in this case is not only what Mr. Richardson knew had happened, but what didn't happen. And that's with respect to the lunch meeting where Mr. Tews today says the agreement was reached was on August 5th. What happened there is very much in dispute. But it is undisputed, that just 5 days earlier, Tews had asked the three of them to sign a unanimous consent form by which they would have agreed to pay this bonus and severance now at issue. He asked that it be signed by August 2nd. It's not signed, and it never has been signed. And then the night of the August 5th lunch meeting, Mr. Tews sends them an email. It's true the subject line says compensation agreement, but the text of the email says Thanks for our discussion today. Attached is a proposed structure, and it lays out a proposed schedule of payments. But I think what is important to Mr. Richardson's state of mind and to our analysis today is the comment, thanks for today's discussion, because what Richardson would objectively believe and what the reasonable person, it seems to me, would objectively believe is that if an agreement had been reached at that lunch meeting, he would have said so. He wouldn't be saying thanks for the discussion. He would say, I'm glad we reached an agreement. Here's how I propose to pay it out. Or I'm glad we reached an agreement. Please go sign that form, something of that nature. So that's a key omission. That's a key component of Mr. Richardson's state of mind. The other thing that I want to jump to that I think is critical is that as soon as the managers discovered what Tews had done, they immediately confronted him, demanded that he repay the money, and even engaged counsel to send him a demand letter. And the demand letter is from the Littler Law Firm, and it's in the record. But you know, it's a strong demand letter. It, in no uncertain terms, accuses Tews of theft. And I think looking at this from an objectively reasonable perspective, as we must, if Mr. Tews really believed that the parties had come to an agreement at that August 5th lunch meeting, one would expect that upon receiving that kind of a letter, you know, before the sun had set, there'd be a response back to the Littler Law Firm. You know, no, I am not a thief. We had an agreement made at the August 5th lunch meeting. Here are the terms, so on and so forth. We have none of that. Nowhere in that period do we have any indication from Tews to the Richardson or the other managers of the company that he, Tews, believes an agreement was reached at that lunch meeting. And so that's the universe of knowledge that Mr. Richardson is taking into the meeting with the police. And based on that universe of knowledge, Tews has not met his burden to establish by clear and specific evidence that Richardson's belief was unreasonable. Now, I do want to touch on causation as well. Of course, causation requires a showing either that the defendant initiated the prosecution or procured it. I think initiation can be handled pretty quickly. This court and several others have held that to initiate a prosecution requires filing formal charges. Now, this court has not had an opportunity to really elaborate on what formal charges means. In the McShirley case, and for example, the defendant admitted filing formal charges with the sheriff, and so the opinion just acknowledges that, and because there was a finding of initiation based on the defendant's admission, there was no need to discuss procurement. But the cases which have looked into the issue, and I think the two most relevant are the Gonzalez case from El Paso and the Anderson case from Dallas that we cite in our brief, say that really this means execution of the charging instrument, that the defendant has really done something that has triggered the responsibility of law enforcement to go do something, and that a mere witness statement or a witness interview is not sufficient to constitute initiation. And that's really all we have here. He's given a statement. The lawyer's memorandum is called a referral, and that's really all it is. So there's no element of an initiation. So we turn to procurement. Because Mr. Tews was indicted by a grand jury, then it becomes his burden to establish, by clear and specific evidence, that Richardson knowingly provided false information to law enforcement and that the decision to prosecute would not have been made but for that false information. And this court held in Vu versus Tran and has in other cases as well, that causation cannot be inferred solely from the falsity. Now, in their brief in this court, Mr. Tews says that there is no evidence to support a conclusion that law enforcement relied on anything other than Richardson's false statement. That, it seems to me, is flipping the burden of proof. It's Mr. Tews' burden to show that the only thing on which law enforcement relied was an allegedly false statement from Richardson. and he hasn't met that burden. And that's, and we know that, excuse me, because we have a two-year window between Richardson going to the police and the grand jury returning an indictment. And we have no evidence of what happened in that two-year window except one exchange of emails between Richardson and the DA's investigator about Tooze's ownership in the company. And in that email, Richardson accurately tells the investigator that Tooze owned an interest in FSA Holdings LLC, which was the owner of Falcon Steel, but did not directly own an interest in Falcon Steel. Whatever else happened in that two-year period, we don't know from this record, and it's Mr. Tooze's burden to have brought that forward. And presumably he could have done it. He's got access to the DA's discovery file now, and we know that. We don't have access to it, and so that's why it's critical that the burden of proof be properly allocated on that issue, and he hasn't met that burden.
Thank you.
I thought I misheard you when you said you were flipping the burden of proof.
Ms. Hubbard?
We don't need a shot caller, we need a hearing aid.
May it please the court, Caitlin Hubbard for Appellee Daniel Tooze. You have heard in briefing and today that my client's evidence was uncredible, makes no sense, and is, say so, unworthy of belief. You were told he is greedy. You were told he, quote, sailed away with $500,000. And you were even told that it is, quote, undisputed he resigned. Then you heard from us. We pointed to clear and specific evidence that appellants, in fact, praised Tooze and attributed Falcon Steel's viability to him, that they systematically entered into written employment agreements that made him eligible for this compensation they claim is too much. And then at August 5th, 2019, that they went to the City Club Cafe in Dallas, Texas, and that all four made an agreement that Mr. Tooze would, in fact, be paid that compensation he earned. You saw that it was not just his say-so, but in fact, there was an internal closing spreadsheet that Rob Richardson circulated on August 19th that, in fact, reserved those funds for Tooze and others. You saw the W-2 payroll IRS filing that was filed not by my client, but in 2020 by appellants.
May I ask you, and I'm sorry I'm not really deep into the weeds on the record, but that spreadsheet that you just alluded to?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did it include a breakdown per eligible employee? I mean, or was it just a lump sum? This is how much we've got set aside.
It said bonuses / stay bonuses, so it included both. It had the stay bonuses demarcated, and then it had a, believe, $525,000 lump sum figure that, in fact, when this closing spreadsheet was given by criminal defense counsel post-indictment to the DA's office, that Mr. Richardson responded the next day and said, by the way, those figures that curiously add up to the amount Dan Tooze distributed, I think it was forged. And yet this is a document we can show in the record was actually circulated by their client weeks before they claim any theft occurred. Oh, you learned further.
Could you address my questions with regard to the W-2?
Yeah, of course.
What can we infer from the W-2 and specifically address counsel's discussion concerning what we can't infer from
the W-2? Sure. And I think the fundamental defect with that argument is that appellants are trying to elevate us to some kind of trial level proof that is not required at the TCPA stage. Specifically with respect to the W-2, it at minimum shows that they paid payroll taxes on it to the federal government and made a representation that that was earned. There in fact is a specific form you can file with the IRS. It was cited in our underlying briefing, and I'm happy to submit a post-submission brief to this court outlining it. The mechanism you can use for the federal government is to file a corrected W-2 showing that an employee, in fact, stole those funds. And in that way, you can get your money back that you inadvertently paid to the, if it was a mistake, paid to the IRS. But I would submit that that's the type of smoking gun evidence that any good lawyer would want to show that, in fact, an agreement was made. But stepping back several steps, you see throughout appellant's brief, they characterize our burden as a heavy or a high one, 10 different times, in fact. What is unfortunately omitted from their brief is the actual TCPA standard, that it is a light burden, modest, not a high hurdle. In fact, that our pleadings and our affidavit testimony, and it is not just pleadings in this case, although there are 22 pages of that, plus a 10-page affidavit, plus dozens of pages of corresponding proof, that all we have to do is present sufficient evidence that, taken as true, is sufficient to support our claim if not controverted. That means fact disputes and battles of the evidence will not suffice. And that's what you're getting here. You're getting their take on the IRS. They can make that take. At summary judgment with more evidence, they can make that take at trial if it gets there. But today at the TCPA, this court's job, as outlined Justice Birdwell and Justice Kerr in McShirley, is to present a prima facie case with clear and specific evidence for each element of the claim. And we do not shy from that standard. Your opinion, Justice Birdwell and Derrigan, it did not hold that a defendant can put on controverting evidence, create a fact dispute, and say, oops, now it's not free from doubt. What Derrigan did is look to the plaintiff's evidence. It held, correctly in my view in that case, that the plaintiff's evidence of damages was completely speculative.
Let me ask you something. One of the things in reading the parts of the record that are highlighted in the briefing, particularly the interaction with the DA's office and the DA's requests and emails, were talking about Michael Morton. They don't mention Brady, but they do mention Michael Morton. And obviously the DA has a statutory and a constitutional duty with regard to exculpatory evidence. Has there been any discussion in any malicious prosecution case, whether it's in the context of a TCPA or otherwise, with regard to whether or not, how we take into consideration the fact that the party responsible, whether initiated, whatever, withheld what effectively would be recognized as Brady or Michael Morton material? Or is that just because that's not something that was part of the initial referral or initiation or whatever, that we can't take a look at effectively what's Brady or Michael Morton?
No, excellent question. I'm glad you asked it. The law, in fact, is that specifically for causation, that the question is, did you either present knowingly false information or withhold exculpatory information? That is the law. That is the standard. And in that context, this whole discussion of three independent layers of decision makers, the police, the prosecutor, the grand jury, it goes away. It evaporates because you remove their discretion and make it impossible for them to exercise it when you withhold that information. We know from the record, we know from circumstantial evidence, that that information was requested from Rob Richardson after the indictment because it had not been provided before. So set aside the knowingly false affirmative information that was provided before, we know that the exculpatory was not.
Did it occur after the DA's office talked to Mr. Fahey, or was that something that the DA's office, in their emails, talking about, we're running our traps on Michael Morton, we're looking at this topic? They don't ever specifically ask for the W-2, but they do specifically ask for
exculpatory, yes.
And they do mention that we have certain duties with regard to exculpatory evidence.
Yes, good question. So it was December 2023. The prosecutor, post-indictment, introduces herself to Mr. Richardson and says, I need this laundry list of information that has not previously been provided to us. That is CR 636 to 637.
But is she doing that because she's indicted Mr. Tooze? Mr. Tooze has retained Mr. Fahey. Mr. Fahey has talked to the DA and said, oh, by the way, they didn't tell you about X, Y, and Z, and now she's come back to Richardson and said, hey, we need this information.
No, I can help you with that question. I understand it now. I apologize.
No.
Ms. Farnell, the prosecutor, and Mark Taylor, the two prosecutors working with the DA's office, did not meet with the criminal defense attorney until March. A weekend, I believe it's like March 9th or March 10th, and that's when they get the email Monday morning before 9 a.m. to Mr. Richardson saying, we want to talk to you face-to-face today. They then presented that document. It was a closing spreadsheet, you can tell from the record, and that's when the next day, after they meet Rob Richardson face-to-face, you get the email from him saying, you know what, I think that must have been forged. That's the evidence. When she was asking for the laundry list of information in December of 2023, that was before she had met with the criminal defense lawyer. Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Where in the record can you show us what the DA's office had to rely upon to make their recommendation to take it to the grand jury?
Great. I'm going to answer your question factually and then legally. So factually, number one, we know that they had the police report, and we know that they had Rob Richardson's emails to them. We have that specifically at CR 615, CR 619. We also know that my client was able in September 2024 to view the criminal file from his attorney, his criminal defense attorney. And I want to be clear on this, did not have the whole criminal file. And there is a case we have cited in our brief, Gunville, that makes clear that once the indictment is dismissed and pulled, then the defendant no longer has that information and you have to subpoena it and to get it. Otherwise, that will come with full discovery. That is why in this record, we have my client saying I was able to meet with my attorney, go through the criminal defense file, and what I saw in it were the communications from Mr. Richardson and appellants to the prosecutor. And we know what they didn't have because then we get the email, Justice Birdwell, that you've asked about after the indictment, asking for all of the exculpatory information. They didn't ask specifically for the W-2. They asked for payroll records, and the W-2 is in paychecks along with all of the other payroll records, so I wanted to clear that up. Legally, I'd like to point you to the fact that the Texas Supreme Court has made quite clear that you can rely on circumstantial evidence to prove causation. That is extremely important because let's take a step back. Under this court's correct precedent, every malicious prosecution claim is going to be subject to the TCPA step one, right? We're always going to get to TCPA step two. So what the appellants are asking you to do, number one, their theory on initiation is that only law enforcement can initiate. I'm going to get to that in a minute. On procurement, they say, unless you have something like the prosecutor's testimony or a criminal file, the complete criminal file that you may only be able to actually produce to a court, notwithstanding the fact that you can put in the record at CR 17 that not much happened during those 2 years, and in fact, I have seen the file, their argument is you need to go and get the evidence from the prosecutor or the grand jury proceedings that are protected by the very privileges that the Texas Supreme Court has said we may never get at a summary judgment or even a trial stage. We're going to have to go through the discovery process. So their ultimate theory is you're never going to get past TCPA step two unless you have that prosecutor testimony who has a privilege to say, I'm not going to do it even later. That is why it is so critically important for circumstantial evidence to be used to satisfy that burden, and that is exactly what Mr. Tews did. If you look at page 45 of our brief, we collected cases where parties put on the knowing falsity of a crime and the type of crime, like this one, that they allege happened, that only was entirely internal to the company. This is not VU, Justice Kerr, where a man comes into a building, there's other witnesses, there's CCTV and audio recordings of him breaking down the door with a machete. This is not an additional witness case. This is the very case that the Texas Supreme Court has told you the jury instruction will be. Did you provide knowingly false information, and but for that information, the criminal proceedings would not have commenced. And by the way, that same case says that more than one person can procure a prosecution. So do not be heard to say that, well, in fact, because it was Richardson and Gans and Cramp and Rainrock, that in fact they get off because they can all point the finger at each other. That's not how it works. Nor does their reply brief argument work where they say, well, there was the Kim memorandum, the criminal referral. That was their attorney. It was their agent. She swore that she relied on the veracity of their affidavits, not that she was some independent witness. And like I said, this isn't even a crime susceptible to additional witnesses. I want to turn.
There's one real quick. There's one question I meant to ask on my Morton deal.
Sure.
Court of Criminal Appeals has rather broadly interpreted the word material in the Michael Morton Act. Has there been any discussion with regard to the interrelationship of the word material in the Michael Morton Act with regard to the element of materiality in malicious prosecution?
You know, that's an interesting thought. I don't know that I've seen that exact discussion, but I've seen discussions close to it. It has to be material.
Because you're essentially arguing that they withheld exculpatory information in order to obtain this prosecution. So it would seem to me that interrelationship is something we might want to explore.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's as material as it gets. And I'll point you, Justice Birdwell, to the Waco Court of Appeals decision in Trainum versus Broadway. It's cited in our brief. It said, I think quite specifically, something to the effect of, well, the claim is theft. And that obviously couldn't have been accurate because they withheld an essential fact, the evidence of consent. So there is no greater materiality than the claim that was reported to the police and the DA's office, and I want to be clear about that. Rob Richardson did not just go to the police, hand it off, and wipe his hands. The evidence is that he went and delivered that criminal referral straight to the DA's office as well, and he met with Mark Taylor within just a couple weeks. And then he was emailing back and forth, too. That is circumstantial evidence of procurement. I told you I'd get back to initiation. That's important. I want to just a minute. I agree with Mr. Williams, my friend on the other side, that initiation is unsettled in the law. But I would tell you this. Their theory, as I previewed, is that only law enforcement can initiate. That's not what the Texas Supreme Court said in Browning-Ferris versus Lee. Their quote was, a person initiates a criminal prosecution if he makes a formal charge to law enforcement. Justice Birdwell, in McShirley, the complaining party didn't actually go and sign an arrest warrant. He went and filed and said there's a specific crime that has been committed, a formal complaint, and then the police go and sign that complaint and the arrest warrant. It's the same with an indictment and grand jury. I get it. But Browning-Ferris made quite clear, a person initiates a criminal prosecution if he makes a formal charge to law enforcement authorities, and it relied on the restatement for that. And here's what the restatement says. The rule stated in this section is applicable only to private persons who initiate or procure the institution of criminal proceedings. It has no application to public officials charged with the enforcement of criminal law and the performance of their public duty. These officials are protected from civil liability. So obviously, initiate has to have a different meaning than what appellants would give it. Now, I would submit to you that just as the French v. French case we cite in our brief, the court can resolve this case very easily at the TCPA stage on procurement. And I want to...
Can we take a look at, for example, with regard to absolute immunity from an administrative standpoint when you file a complaint with the state bar, okay? That complaint, you're absolutely immune from any type of civil liability with regard to making a formal complaint. Is there any discussion in maybe that type of case law that would discuss what it means to be a formal complaint as opposed to, is there a particular form that has to be filed, or is it just the initiation of the complaint or the referral, if you will, with regard to the state?
Sure.
Or the state entity that is tasked with enforcing the law, that there's a violation is formally made, a complaint.
I haven't seen the analog to the administrative context, but I have seen the case.
You know what I'm talking about, though.
Sure.
You're absolutely immune. I can go tell the state bar right now something horrible about you, and I'd be absolutely immune. There's not a thing you can do about it. But that's an analog, if you will.
Yeah.
But
we know that's not the law here because malicious prosecution exists for the very reason of protecting private citizens from false and improper and malicious prosecutions, and that's the case we have here. So that's not a direct analog. But with respect to what it means to file a formal charge, I think it's a continuum between what clearly is not initiate, which is what the appellants have pointed you to, where you just have a witness report. You don't directly say there was theft and larceny above $300,000. And then you have this type of case where there is a criminal referral delivered to both the Haltom City Police Department and the DA's office that specifically lists the crime that they're alleging, and that is, in fact, the crime charged when you get there. But again, I would suggest to the court that this case can be decided on procurement. I want to, on that note, quickly distinguish the Vu case, Justice Kerr. If you read that case, it's very clear that the problem in Vu is that there was a mismatch between what Tran reported, which was criminal mischief, which was occurring, it was undisputed, using a meat cleaver to break down a door, and the crime charged of burglary. That broke the causal chain because it didn't matter that Tran didn't tell police, hey, by the way, he might have a right to be on premises because he's a tenant. In that case, she was only reporting what actually happened, which she had heard from a frightened employee. He's using a meat cleaver to break down the door. That did not cause a burglary charge. Here, there's no such mismatch, nor is this an additional witness case. Briefly, on probable cause, you have not heard today the argument in their brief that there's three layers of decision makers. You haven't heard it for a very good reason. There is binding precedent from this court, Vu, Justice Kerr, you even had another opinion I found when looking this up preparing, Bearden, just a couple of few years ago. There's Texas Supreme Court precedent. There is unanimous Court of Appeals precedent that you do not get to say, well, you know, that prosecutor, they really agreed there was probable cause, so I must have had it too. Just like we can't say that prosecutor received new information and dismissed it and moved for immediate expunction, we can't say that. They can't say it either. What matters is what was in Rob Richardson's mind at the time he made the report. And we have clear, specific, abundant evidence, pleadings, affidavits, corroborating evidence that an agreement was made on August 5th. Everything they want you to believe otherwise is a fact dispute. This is not a high hurdle. The question here is if my client provided enough factual detail taken as true to support his claims at the TCPA stage. He did. My final comment would be with respect to malice and innocence that I'm not hearing today, just as in McShirley, Your Honors. Those are basically derivative. Once you find causation, once you find lack of probable cause, malice can be inferred from the lack of probable cause. It can be inferred from providing knowingly false and incomplete information. We also have someone that went to the police to report a theft 2 years after the fact without disclosing the August 5th agreement, the internal closing spreadsheet, the meetings that my client put in his pleading that they had discussing this very compensation in the weeks after. And this is no slight agreement. There is clear and specific evidence of exactly how that agreement was made and when.
Thank you, Ms. Hubbard. Rebuttal, Mr. Williams.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I know the court will carefully review the record, but I want to clarify what I think may be some misconceptions about what is and is not in the record. The spreadsheet that is found at page 598 of the clerk's record is dated August 19. It's before Mr. Tews resigned. It's a reserve of funds that we think we may need to pay down the road, and it sets forth receivables we think we're still going to collect. And in fact, what it says for Mr. Tews is $165,000, which doesn't correspond to anything else. I don't think that's the same spreadsheet that Richardson is seeing when he says, I think it's forged. Our record doesn't answer that question. But in any event, that comment is made after the indictment, so it could not have caused the indictment. He says, I think it is forged. It's his opinion, and it's in no way an element of causation. But the spreadsheet at 598 of the clerk's record was prepared before Tews resigned. With respect to his resignation, he did resign, and it is undisputed. The document on which they rely at page 555 and 56 of the clerk's record where it is an email exchange with the company's insurance carrier. And it's true that Mr. Tews is referred to as a former CFO, but the very same email says he's going to stay on to wind up the business. And if he had, maybe we wouldn't be here today. His employment agreement said he's entitled to severance if his employment is terminated. It doesn't say he's entitled to it if his position as CFO is eliminated. And that's all that happened until he resigned. Now, with respect to the W-2 form, you know, I don't believe the record supports what they suggest in their brief, which is that in their brief they suggest that Richardson withheld the W-2 and only after the DA's office repeatedly demanded it did he turn it over. The record doesn't support that kind of contention. What the record does support about the W-2 are really two things. First, in that December 23rd email the counsel just mentioned to Mr. Richardson, it says, among other things, we understand some, if not all, of relevant HR and or payroll have already been provided. And then he lists some other things that need to be provided and says nothing specifically about a W-2. And then, perhaps more importantly, in March of 2024, the investigator sends Mr. Richardson an email, and it's at page 640 of the clerk's record, and he says, this is the investigator to Richardson, he says, I can't recall if we talked about this before. If we did, I can't find my notes on it. Did Rain Rock Falcon Steel report the Tews theft amount on a W-2 or 1099? If so, can I get a copy of that, please? He sends that email at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. By 8:30 the next morning, Richardson has already provided it to him. And that's why I think the allocation of the burden of proof is so important. We don't know what happened in the two-year period between the police report and the grand jury indictment, except for one email, which was absolutely accurate. And it is it is Mr. Tews' burden to establish by clear and specific evidence that he would not have been indicted but for whatever information supposedly is false that was provided to the prosecutors. With respect to the element of initiation, I'm not suggesting that only law enforcement can initiate. Of course not. And in McShirley itself, the defendant said, "I filed a formal complaint." So certainly it does not just mean law enforcement, but what it does mean is that the defendant has done something of a formal nature to trigger the obligation or at least responsibility of law enforcement to go do something. And of course, what happened in McShirley, that was an arrest case, not a grand jury case, but they got an arrest warrant and went out and made the arrest. That's not what happened here. This is just the witness interview and witness report, like we saw in Gonzalez and Anderson, just bringing information to the attention of law enforcement for it to do with as it sees fit and as it chooses. And the cases hold that that's insufficient.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. We thank you for the oral argument. It's been very helpful. With that, your case is submitted, and everybody's free to go. Thank you.
Thank you.